Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Eight minutes after 9 o'clock. California love, exactly. And if you don't get it, don't worry about it. Joining me from, of all places, Georgia, is Alex Hollings. Alex, what's going on, man? How are you? More importantly, how's your mom?
Things are going pretty well. My mom is still at work, despite my best efforts to get her to retire or quit.
Wait a minute, I thought she tested positive.
No. So she went in for testing.
Oh.
The testing was supposed to take 8 days to get back to her, so she was put in quarantine with a presumptive positive. Then she ended up getting a rapids test, which I guess the turnaround is much faster. She tested negative, but then went on to test positive for the antibodies later. So it looks like she did have it, but somehow didn't test positive, but has since gotten over it. To be honest with you, at this point, after the reading that I've been doing about the rapid testing and the antibody testing, I understand that effectively it's difficult to know reliably either way in some cases. Like,
well, that's comforting.
Yeah, yeah. But what is important is that my mom's fever broke.
That's good.
She ended up doing much, much better. She was really sick there for about a week. But now she's all the way back on her feet and back to being at work with cloth face masks because they don't have any N95 masks in her facility still. So I'm frustrated and I'm stressed out, but I am happy that at least for now she's doing well.
How do you cope with your stressed out nature? You were stressed out 2 weeks ago. Is there anything you do? Do you make more knives?
You know, it's a great question. I've been doing a poor job of it. I think I probably should be making more knives or spending more time in my workshop. But, you know, it's a busy time in the news business, too. So I've mostly just been too busy to let myself think about it much. And I think that that's been my coping mechanism.
There you go. Hide from it. There you go. Stay busy, hide from it, and then deal with it when you need to. You know what? There's a lot of people that's a well-traveled path, my friend.
I would contend that it's probably not the smartest path.
Oh, no. No, absolutely. Nobody said it was smart. It's just well-traveled.
Promised my wife over the weekend that this week my goal is to not go back to work after I put my daughter to bed. I have a bad habit.
Yeah.
It started as being like, okay, she went to bed. I'll check on a few things. To now it's like, well, now I have 3 more hours that I could feasibly get stuff done.
Right.
And I need to break that habit. My employer is actually really good about work-life balance. It's me that isn't.
No, you know, when you're responsible, and that's the problem of working from home. You know, when the laptop got invented and you could, you know, bring stuff home, no bueno, man. No bueno. Because it's like, damn, if I do that now, and so you wind up imbalancing your life even more than it's already imbalanced, which is not a good thing. But I'll tell you what, I think as the workplace has been transformed, for those of us that people that used to have offices that they went to and now they work from home, and as companies have seen, you know what, we can function like this, it works. I think the hours of the workplace, the physical workplace, now can be more easily and more appropriately brought home, as opposed to the feeling like I've got to do more because I'm working from home. And I think it's going to be a more comfortable workplace. You know what I'm saying? That the same expectations, you know, will be in both places to include ours.
No, I really think that you're right.
Well, there you have it. I love when he signs off like that. I really think that you're right. What happened? Hollings. Call ended. Huh. Not sure what's going on. Nope, here you come. I thought you signed off with, "I really think you're right," and then hung up.
I was just like, yeah, that's the end of the conversation. No, I'm sorry.
Which I thought was totally appropriate, and I love when people do that. I thought that was an awesome that was an awesome way for him to sign off. Well done, my friend.
Said everything that we need to say. No, somehow, you know, I've got too many disparate forms of technology on my desk, and it's switched from my MacBook to my whatever this Alexa thing is with a screen. And then I apologize for that. But what I was saying is that I think you're totally right. And I think a lot of companies are going to realize how much more cost effective it is to have people work from home. There's a huge amount of overhead tied into paying for the lease on office space, paying for the utilities on this space. The downside, I would argue, with that is that Americans, by and large, are not very good at enforcing our own work-life balance. You know, Americans take less vacation time than other countries. Americans tend to work more hours than other countries. And to a certain extent, I think that's a good thing. I think that that's why the fact that we don't have siestas benefits us, you know. But to a certain extent, I think that we're going to see a big shift in employment culture, and people are going to have to kind of become more self-reliant in order to really pull off this working from home thing. I mean, you know as well as I do, you need to be really disciplined to be able to still get stuff done while you're in your living room, you know?
And also, though, you also need to be disciplined. I mean, because I've got a 16-year-old daughter, and when, you know, she's here, I mean, when I'm by myself, I can come back in here and it doesn't impact anybody. But when she's here, you know, as opposed to, you know, going down the coast highway, taking the dogs and going for a drive and grabbing something to eat and shooting the shit or watching The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel together or doing something else, you know, you have to be disciplined in terms of giving your family, you know, what your family deserves. And it's hard when, you know, you can, you know, you feel like you have to get something done and you get in there. And I'll tell you what, and if you say you're going to go in there, I'm just going to go in there for 15 minutes. It's never 15 minutes.
There's no such thing. Yeah. And what a great point you're making that I'm now trying to get myself to learn. Like, you're totally right. I'm very good at being disciplined about work. I'm not very good at being disciplined about giving my family recreation time together.
Well, you know? And let me be critical of you here in public relative to your wife. I mean, so you respect the time when your daughter's still awake, but when it's just you and me, you head in the other room, right? And that's what.
And that's true.
I mean, and that's the problem with it is, and they're gracious and they know you're working hard and they know, and they're like, it's okay. But I mean, if the sensitive creature that I am, I mean, if somebody did that to me all the time, I'd be like, well, wait a minute. Like, so what am I, chop liver?
And when are we supposed to watch a show together?
Yeah.
You know, when are we supposed to do any of the mom and dad stuff? I would say the husband and wife stuff that you used to do before you were mom and dad.
I think the most important thing is the boyfriend, girlfriend stuff. Because
you're right. You
know, husband and wife, right? I mean, come on. But boyfriend, girlfriend, yeah. When do we do that? When do we have fun? When do we, you know, hang out? When do we, you know, do whatever? And but again, the danger to me, it starts with, you know, you never ever get out of bed and roll into work in your office at home in your sweats, and you know, you get up, you get ready, you shower, you put clothes on, you eat breakfast, right? And you're in your office at a certain time. You take lunch at a certain time. You go PT. You might come back. You come back in for a few hours, and then the day is done.
See, this is where I'm failing. Because
it's hard.
My work day.
Yeah, it's hard.
You know, on the beginning end, I used to get up every morning and spend a good 45 minutes to an hour just drinking my coffee in the living room and hanging out with my wife and my kiddo. Right. You know. But then that quickly turned into I spend that time going through my phone for all – you know, as a journalist, it's in, like I'm on every social media channel, and you never know – you have to kind of sift through the messages that you get. Some of them are just people, you know, swearing at you.
Oh,
some of them are important things, right? So it became – I would sift through that in my morning as I drank my coffee, which is a little less attention than I'm paying my family. And then that slowly evolved into, all right, I do that for a half an hour and I go into my office a half hour earlier. So now I'm at that point where I get up, I make a cup of coffee, I sit down. Usually I get up a bit before my kiddo does. You know, I sit down with her for a second and then I say, okay, love you, Bean. And I go down to my office. And I used to take a lunch. Don't take a lunch anymore. I used to take PT time. I don't do that anymore. I come up at 5, spend from 5 to 8 with my daughter, and I come back down. And no one's making me do it. It's just that there's a lot to get done, you know. But I think that you're making an excellent point in that. And ultimately, when I'm 70 years old, I'm not going to be like, man, if only I had gone back and spent 3 more hours in my office every night. Instead, I'd be like, man, if only I had actually hung out with my wife, you know. So I think that I, to a certain extent, the fact that I'm a little OCD about getting my work done has helped me succeed. But at the end of the day, I don't want to become the type of guy where all I am is my work, because right. So much of my work, being a good writer, is about being relatable. And if all I do is read about foreign policy, I'm not that relatable, you know.
No, I'm with you. But again, a lot of people are going through it. How do you do it? How do you do it? How do you do it well? And especially, you know, you've just taken on, a new gig with all the pressures
and a big initiative,
right? Trying to make it go, and to me, that's when, you know, job creep happens. It's this pressure you feel, but I think. I had somebody email me when I was talking about this a while ago, and they said, you know, rules help. And they said, you know, that you can have like one waiver a week, but you got to give at least like 6 hours notice. And they said it just makes it harder and harder for you to do that, which is a good thing for both you, your relationship with your significant other, and ultimately for work. And because if you look at her and say, you know, hey, I'm going to do this again. To me, I would look at you and say, hey, instead of getting up at 6, why don't you get up at 4 when I'm still asleep? And it doesn't take away from our time.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, absolutely. You know?
There's an interesting compromise, because what difference does it make if I do it between 4 and 7 or if I do it between 7 and 10 tonight? And the answer, the 3 hours that she's sleeping – you know, you then transfer to quality time with you and her being boyfriend and girlfriend. That's probably a good thing.
I think you're totally right. I think that's actually a real good idea. And I aside from that, I've been trying really hard to sell myself on the idea of doing some PT in the morning. I've never been a morning PT guy. I've always been an afternoon guy. I was always in the gym at Chow. But I think just getting my blood flowing a bit in the morning would do me some good, as opposed to spending my first hour of work kind of – trying to fight through the fog as I familiarize myself with all the stuff that's gone on in the past 24 hours. I think if I went out and took like a 15, 20 minute run and came back, I'd probably be in way better shape for the remaining 40 minutes of that first hour, right? I'd get more done, I think.
Now, let me ask you a question. Do you have a treadmill at home?
I don't. I do have a recumbent bicycle, but to be totally honest with you, I've run into this problem before. I'm a pretty big guy. You know, I weigh 230 pounds.
You'll break it?
The seat creaks under my big fat ass. Yeah, it really does, which drives me and my wife both crazy, because it's like – so I need to invest in a piece of equipment that could support adult-sized men, I think is what I need.
Because here's what – I built a pull-up bar in my backyard.
I'd really be interested to talk to you about how you did that. I've always wanted to, but never pulled the trigger on doing it.
Hey, it's 2 4x6s with some quickcrete and a one inch plumbing pipe.
That's awesome, man. And
it's pretty wide too. And there's nothing wrong with the little whip in that bar, just so everybody knows. All right, like yesterday, I was out doing pull-ups. But here's my point to you is this. You could do a 15-minute workout where you do 3 sets of pull-ups where, you know, I set my like treadmill on like 7 or 8. I set it on 6 at first, set of pull-ups. You know, you can do some ab work, you know, you could do some core work, you could do some stretching, right? And then you hop on, and for 30 to 45 seconds, you know, you run. You run hard. And then you hop off, you do another set of pull-ups. You know, so you're not you don't have to do an hour's worth of PT, and you don't have to. And I don't like running long distance anymore. I've done enough of it in my life. And so I've read, look, get your heart rate up. And I'm like, okay, I could do that, right? So the treadmill gets sets at 8. And then in 15 minutes, you're like, okay, man, let's do this shit. Let's go. So, no, I think you're on the right. But, again, it's got to fit into your work schedule, because if it doesn't, it's kind of like my little COVID-19 thing. Sweden did and is attempting to do things that are sustainable. Everybody else, most people, most communities in the United States, we did what was unsustainable. We hit stop, right? We hit stop. It's not sustainable. And so how do we do it? What Sweden said is, okay, this thing's going to be here for a while. How do we do things that are sustainable? So, and to me, the way things don't work, especially physical fitness, is they're not sustainable in your schedule. And so you do it for the first 2 weeks, and you're like, postpone it a couple times a week, and then next week you say, yeah, I can't do that.
And you're totally right, because it's all about making allowances. When it comes to trying to maintain a good, healthy habit or trying to maintain discipline, people don't realize that you tend to chip away at them, right? You go, I'm not going to do it today, but I'll get back to it tomorrow. And the first time that you do that, you don't feel a whole lot of guilt, right? And then the second time you do it, you don't feel a whole lot of guilt until you do it every day. And then all of a sudden you go, oh man, I haven't worked out in 3 weeks. You know, it's really easy to give yourself a pass when you do it on an individual day basis. But the problem is that those allowances cascade into a habit, and then the habit becomes allowing it, as opposed to the habit being not allowing your bad behavior.
Right. No, but again, you know, that's why, in my opinion, these things, these kind of little negotiated things you put into your workday when you live at home are really important. You know, and I always tell people, don't take your time in the evening with your girlfriend, right? And they're like, I don't have a girlfriend, I have a wife. I said, treat her like she's your girlfriend, not your wife, okay? That's important.
That's the secret. Yeah, right? I agree with that.
I'm going to give you a little tip there. Treat her like she's your girlfriend. And then that time that you were going to use, take it out of your sleep, right? Take it out of your sleep. And then if you need to take a nap, wait till your kid takes a nap and pile it on that stuff, right? That's always a good nap when you nap with your kid.
I honestly really am. I'm that guy. Like, I've had sleep studies done and whatnot. I don't sleep a lot. I think I'm just one of those folks that I operate pretty well on not that much sleep. However, I have a bad habit of wasting my evening time with unnecessary stress. I sit there worrying about things that I'm not getting done, you know? And what I need to work on using those hours functionally, like to hang out with my wife, you know, or maybe even a book that isn't work related.
Ooh,
I haven't done that. You know,
there's a novel concept.
Although, you know, I'm very fortunate that it's a blurry line for me, because in a very real way, what I do for a living is what I always dreamt of doing. I really like what I do. So the line between a workbook and a non-workbook is kind of blurry. Like, I read Call Sign Chaos, I think, more for me than I did for work, you know, but I can always call it work when I'm doing it, which makes me feel better, I guess. But I miss kind of junk fiction. I haven't read any junk fiction.
Oh, and you're a junk fiction guy, which leads us to UFOs. The Navy is like making your life. I mean, come on, for Star Trek geeks like you and Star Wars people. I mean, the Navy releasing their video and all this other stuff.
Something important to say about those videos.
What do you make of it?
First and foremost, we should all acknowledge that the Navy did just release these videos, but they've been around for years,
right?
And we already knew that they were Navy videos. I think that the Navy's decision to release them right now was a bit of clever PR, because they're getting a whole lot of bad press, and it changed the direction of some headlines.
Really? You think it's that diabolical?
Well, why on earth? I mean, I covered the story last September when the Navy acknowledged that the videos were real and gave statements on it. And 6 months later, the Navy released the videos again as though it was a new thing. And that seems like a pretty creative bit of timing, seeing as the videos had already been released. The Navy had already acknowledged them. The Navy had already given official statements on the matter. But then we released new official statements on the matter that were the same as the old ones. I don't know. I can't think of any other good reason to do this right
now.
None.
There's, so you thought about it and you thought, is there any – is there any good reason that this could happen other than
every message has a motive?
The Roosevelt shit show, the day to day soap opera that is the Theodore Roosevelt.
Yeah, exactly.
So the Navy's running its own disinformation campaign.
I wouldn't call it disinformation. I would say that this is pretty common practice. The White House, and I don't just mean the Trump White House. I mean like every White House. Has been super guilty of this. We usually call them Friday dumps,
right.
But it happens pretty often. Like basically, let's say the White House, and you could call it the Trump or the Obama White House, it doesn't matter. But let's say the White House knows that they have three stories that they're really going to get dragged through the mud over. They're going to release all three of them at the same time on Friday afternoon. The reason being that our outrage can really only focus on one or two things at a time. We're not going to be outraged about three things at once. So we'll pick one, and the other two will get less exposure. And because over the weekend we all kind of consume news less, by Monday morning there will be a new big story. You know, not always, but pretty often. So they use these Friday dumps to kind of trick us into not paying as much attention to some things that otherwise might have been some bad press. The military certainly uses the same practice. A lot of times we use it with civilian casualty scores, things like that. We dump it all at once so that you have to pick something to focus on. And I could see releasing these UFO videos being one of those where there was a group of people in a meeting and they were like, literally every headline and every major outlet this week is about something that looks bad for us. Let's try to change up that narrative a little. If I were in charge, I would do that.
So Gilday comes in and says, God damn it, I need a shiny object for these rubes. Somebody give me one.
And then maybe not Gilday. It very well could have been a decision at a PAO level, but yeah.
And you're in the corner doodling, right, looking down. All of a sudden you look up and say, UFOs always works.
Yep, exactly.
Who is that guy? Oh, that's Hollings. That's a Petty Officer Hollings. He's been reduced twice, and he's on. He's getting med boarded. He's getting med boarded. Yeah. Hey, sir. Look, nobody likes to listen to me, but let me tell you, UFOs work every fucking time.
Stomach hanging over my web belt, right?
Promote. But again, hey, we're talking if you were in the Navy now, so nobody's even going to notice that.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair.
Right. Seems like a smart young man. Who's on? Am I on that med board? Sir, you're never on those. I want to be on that one. All of a sudden, you're like, you've got a battlefield commission. But, sir, we're not at war. Don't fuck with the details, Hollings. You're now the head of PAO of the Navy. Get after that shit.
It's the secret, man. It's the secret. I'll say this. Those videos certainly are interesting. There's three videos, but they effectively come from two different events. One video was from the 2004 – people call it the Nimitz encounter.
Yes.
That was off the coast of San Diego with the Nimitz carrier strike group. The other two videos came from a different event that seems – it was effectively the same day, different aircraft, different pilots. I think that what we see in those videos is very interesting. To be honest with you, it's the 2004 Nimitz one in particular that catches my attention because the little dot, whatever it is that we're looking at, stops. It changes directions really quickly. Those are things that are weird because we have hypersonic technology at this point. We have actual man-made vehicles that can travel in excess of Mach 5. We've measured some in excess of Mach 20, right? So we know we can go fast, but what we can't do is go fast and then stop fast because we're made out of bones and water, and that stuff doesn't respond well to the inertia of stopping that quickly, right? So when I see those things, that's what really stands out to me, is that they're changing direction very quickly. It leads me to believe that there's nothing made out of biological matter inside whatever we're looking at, right? They've got to be mechanical in nature or natural phenomena, you know, like electricity can do things that a squirrel can't, right? So there is one bit of Navy technology that feasibly could explain these things away. but it is admittedly a leap. So back in 2018, the Navy, the Secretary of the Navy actually filed a patent for what's called laser-induced plasma filament technology. And in effect, they use this to make, I mean, for lack of a better term, a plasma hologram using lasers. The idea is to use it for aircraft defense. So let's say you're in an F-35 in contested airspace. Stealth aircraft are not actually invisible to lower band radar arrays like S-band and L-band, but you can't use those for a weapons grade lock. So in other words, you could use a lower band radar to know F-35s are inbound, but you couldn't use it to guide a radar guided munition, right? However, what you could feasibly do is use that to kind of figure out the general area of an F-35 or an F-22,
yeah,
and then launch infrared seeking missiles in the general direction, right? So what this technology would feasibly do is it can create what's effectively a plasma hologram with an actual heat signature with a very similar index to a fighter jet's exhaust. And what that'll do is it'll lure an infrared-seeking missile to the decoy rather to the aircraft itself. This is technology that we legitimately have. The Army has used it to create a plasma ball 100 meters away from the source that could relay human speech in midair. This is absolutely insane sci-fi channel technology
it
to
is.
Me.
You're like – you're pegging the dork meter right now.
You know, but this stuff is real. And what we're looking at is very realistically using it. You could even use it to affect visual wavelengths of light, which means that you could make it visible to the human eye. It would not look like an aircraft to you. It would look like something really weird with the basic IR signature of an aircraft shape with an aircraft exhaust. But if your goal was not to make it look like an aircraft, you could feasibly make it look like, you know, just about anything that you want, depending on the level of technology and how much power you have to use. And that's the real thing here, because the Nimitz encounter honestly could have been faked using this technology. But then you have to ask yourself, this was in 2004. We filed the patent in 2018. This was an incident that involved a Navy strike group. The Navy was the one that filed the patent. It seems unlikely to me that the Navy would use its own tech against itself, right? But I do have to say, when you're looking at, you know, realistically, what do we think this could be? It's kind of more realistic to me to say this technology that maybe we're a few decades off and where we think it ought to be for it to be working that well in 2004, a few decades off is still kind of more believable to me than a few million light years off.
Ooh.
You know? So I don't know. I'm really interested in what we see in those videos. But as long as there are things that we kind of have in our toolbox that you could use to explain it away to some degree,
yes,
it really leads me to go, you know, maybe there's something going on here. I do think there's something going on here, but I'm not sure they're from Zeta Reticuli, you know?
What was that thing you just said?
A faraway star system.
Oh, yeah, you went deep. Geek on
Sorry,
me.
I'm more apt to believe that the thing – I'm more concerned when we see glowing balls over the Pacific. I'm a lot more worried about China than I am about Mars, you know?
Got it. All right. The next topic. So we've covered the fact that your mom's all right. The X-37 Bravo was launched again, right? And with various payloads, are you excited about the X-37 Bravo? What are your thoughts on that thing?
So my take on the X-37 is that I think it's actually our most capable and advanced reconnaissance and surveillance satellite. And the reason why I say that is because, you know, the United States has some of the most advanced spy satellites in the world, right? The problem is that it takes about a decade from design to deployment on one of these advanced spy satellites. So by the time you launch, the technology you're actually putting into orbit is usually about 10 years behind the technology that we could feasibly leverage at the day of launch, right? And, you know, it's a long timeline in terms of contracting, subcontracting, production, testing, so forth. Okay. Now, what the X-37 offers us that doesn't is a redeployable asset, where the body of the spaceship, the spacecraft itself, we know is vetted for orbital use. We know it will survive launch. We know it'll survive reentry. We know that we can manage it while it's in orbit. So all we need to change out is its payload, right? So we could take technology that's a year old, mount it in the bay of the X-37B, deploy that, use it for as long, however long that we feel is necessary, or to capture enough information to know that this particular surveillance technology is worthwhile to deploy in a permanent satellite. And then we can bring it back down, swap out the payload, and start again. So I think what we get out of the X-37B is not only like an extremely abbreviated testing and development cycle, but we also get the ability to take the latest stuff that we have on hand and position it over anything that we need to position it over, collect whatever data we need to collect, and then operate using that intelligence that we otherwise wouldn't be able to grab. So, like, I'm a big fan of this platform because not only can we use it to test space technologies, but we can very literally use it to capture data that we would not otherwise have any means to capture. I think it's a really exciting program, and I think 30 years from now, when they're declassifying the stuff that it's doing now, we're going to find that the X-37 has probably spent a great deal of time over places like North Korea, you know?
We do that, right? We say it's for one thing, but it's really another. One experiment testing the microwave transmission of solar energy captured from space has the potential to change the world. The idea of collecting solar energy in space and transmitting it to Earth was first described by Peter Glasser in 1968. Glasser subsequently acquired a patent in 1973. During the Carter administration, when an energy crisis rocked the world during the Iranian Revolution, NASA and the Energy Department conducted feasibility studies of the concept.
That's interesting stuff, man. I think that it's absolutely feasible, especially when you think about how rapidly solar technology has developed in recent years, right? Solar panels used to be – you could cover your whole roof in solar panels and you might get lucky if it'll run the microwave. Now you can buy an RV with a solar roof that will run the air conditioning for your RV, you know?
Right.
So we've really come really far. But I think that the one thing that's still limiting us on our ability to leverage things in orbit or further – is basically still just that cost of getting stuff up there and getting stuff back. You know, we're even with the huge leaps that we've made with SpaceX, we're still talking, you know, $10,000 a pound for a one-way trip into orbit. So basically, you know, it basically comes down to the same thing as you'll get in the commercial industry, where the technology in the iPhone 16 already exists. It's just cost prohibitive to use, right?
Got it.
I think the technology to leverage solar power, the technology to leverage mineral deposits and asteroids, the technology's there. It's just still a little too cost prohibitive to use. But because the technology's there, that means that it's really just a question of timeline, right? Like, once a technology is developed, almost always, as time goes by, we find ways to make it cheaper, we find ways to make it smaller, we find ways to make it work better. So if we have the tech on hand today, I think that's what's crazy about living in the world that we live in now. It's easy to forget that in like 60 years, we went from the first airplane flight to the moon, you know, and in the 60 years since then, we may have let a lot of aviation technology kind of stagnate, but communications technology, you know, green energy technology, things like that haven't. So when it comes to stuff like that, I'm reluctant to stand up and applaud. I don't think it's going to fix anything today, but I don't know, man. 20 years from now, the whole system might work different than it does now.
Whoa. All right. So that's the and again, this is kind of space shuttle-esque in terms of launch, return to Earth, relaunch, return to Earth.
Absolutely. It's, you know, it looks a lot like a space shuttle. It's about a third the size of the shuttle.
If you've never actually seen the space shuttle, holy, I was surprised. It's the Smithsonian Aerospace Museum that's out by Dulles, not downtown. The thing is gigantic. It is, I mean, literally you see it and you're like, holy shit. And the closer you get, the bigger it gets. And you're just like, good Lord, man, the space shuttle is a monstrosity.
The space shuttle was one of my favorite things to research and write about for a couple of reasons. One being that it was actually kind of a failure. It was a failure that we're really proud of. But the idea behind the shuttle was supposed to be making launches cost effective by reusing the shuttle. By the end of the shuttle program, it cost like $1 billion a launch. It was absolutely astronomically expensive for a million different reasons, but one of them just being that the technology wasn't really there for a genuinely reusable spacecraft. So we were still effectively strapping a giant fuel tank and two huge rockets to the shuttle for every launch, which isn't that much more cost effective than just using one rocket, you know? But what's really cool about the space shuttle is that it's kind of what made space travel boring. And if you think about it, that's an incredible accomplishment. Space is like, you know, Star Trek said it themselves, you know, to boldly go where no man has gone before, it should be a mind blower. But space shuttle operations, even with two terrible tragedies, were overwhelmingly so safe, overwhelmingly pretty mundane, to the point where we stopped watching launches. You know, SpaceX has kind of brought that back a little. But the space shuttle's biggest success was really that we mastered the art of orbital flight to the point where Americans didn't think much of it anymore. And that's incredible when you think about it. And we did it so well for so long that we all kind of just shrug our shoulders and think it's not that big a deal.
Interesting. All right, let me ask you one more question. One of the things I think if you're a military guy that you look at in this whole COVID-19 thing is, were I the Chinese, were I the Russians, I'd certainly be taking notes. And then if I ever did have an idea that I was going to get after Taiwan or some other large military operations, it would be preceded by about 90 days of injecting some kind of virus into the Western world, specifically the United States.
I mean, if you think about it, a virus is the most cost-effective way, we now know for sure, to take a carrier strike group out of operation.
To take an economy and turn it upside down, right? All of that. And so how do you think the DOD has performed, and do you think there are long-term lessons for this?
I think the biggest lesson that we're going to have to take away from this in the DOD, and honestly, as we look at how our society is structured, is that we have created so much bureaucracy in just about everything that we do that we've really compromised our ability to pivot quickly. You know, whether we're talking about military strategy, or we're talking about governmental strategy, or we're talking about little things like my registration is going to expire on my car this month. The DMV is not open. I got pulled over by a cop yesterday who was saying, hey, you know, your registration's going to expire. And I was like, yeah, what am I supposed to do about that? And he went, yeah, I don't really know. But we're still pulling people over for it. We're not good at understanding where the fat is that we need to cut through when it comes to something like this. And I think that we should all recognize that the threat that COVID presented to our society was genuinely never really a everybody's going to die type of threat, right? It was nowhere near as significant a threat as something that was as prevalent as COVID-19 but had the mortality rate of Ebola, right? Or something like that. The threat was never that bad, that significant. And it still had this much of an effect on our economy, our military infrastructure, our capability, not just to defend ourselves, but to provide a stabilizing presence globally that the U.S. Navy really does provide. There's a lot of really hard lessons that we're going to have to learn here about how quickly we can move our footing when something like this happens. And I hope that the DOD is already on top of that, that they're already looking at, okay, what can we do next time
so that it doesn't take five weeks? Give me one, because, you know, when you have the governor of the state of New York going on TV every day for an hour and a half doing his Chicken Little impersonation, right? And the problem is the uncertainty. People don't know for sure. And here's the governor of the state of New York saying, hey, what's happened in New York City is coming to your city. I need 30,000 respirators. He used 6. We sent a U.S. Naval Hospital ship up there, treated less than 200 patients and went home. The one in Los Angeles treated less than 70 and went home. And so in the midst of this cacophony, the symphony, if you will, of disinformation, right, the DOD is going to have to do what? Tell the Roosevelt, you got to stay at sea, right? You got a job to do. And, you know, the last time this happened, we had one person off your ship die. Okay, so you're going to ride it out at sea. What do we do? And, oh, by the way, the best they can tell now, the first cases appeared from the crews of the CODs who were going to flying to and from, you know, airfields along the way and not from Vietnam.
I think there's one important thing there, though, is that we shouldn't look at, you know, the Mercy not treating that many patients as a bad thing. We should look at it as a good thing. We shouldn't look at Cuomo vastly overestimating what he needed and needing significantly less. Well, I think to a certain extent that has to do with his marketing tactics.
Right.
I also think that a lot of these numbers that we are now reevaluating, to a certain extent we're reevaluating these numbers because the federal and state level efforts worked to varying degrees, but we took, I would argue, unprecedented steps to stem the flow of this, and it looks as though it stemmed the flow of this to at least a certain degree. I understand that a lot of people want to be very critical of the Trump administration for how they handled it. I understand a lot of other people want to be very critical for those who did not like the way the Trump administration handled this. But what's important for us to all recognize is that this was new, you know, for the Trump administration and for everyone else. So I think the lessons we learned shouldn't necessarily be next time don't do this because it turned out we didn't need the comfort or the mercy, or next time don't do this because it turned out that only one guy from the Roosevelt died. I think we should be looking at it and trying to determine which things that we did that genuinely did have a positive effect, which things that we did that had negligible effects. And we should make a plan for next time so that we don't have to wait to make those decisions that were good. They should just be a part of the SOP.
Well, I use Governor Cuomo as simply, again, you know, I think you and I talked about this, but this is dynamic decision making, which is much mm-hmm. closer on the spectrum to what we do in the military as opposed
and
to
something
what
that politicians are just generally uncomfortable with.
Yeah, they don't do. They put it in a committee. Gets brought out, it comes to the floor, it gets negotiated. They don't do this. And you can see the level of, in my opinion, there's elements of Chicken Little because they're politicians. And so in the midst of this environment, the DOD is going to have to next time say, what if this was intentionally inflicted? And should we go on a higher alert now, which means we're not going to be able to, while we will shut stuff down, we will not stop operating.
I would argue that they'll probably establish an SOP that would allow them to continue operating, but operating under the assumption that because we need to make sure that we remember that not all viruses are created equal. So right. The next one may not be as severe, or the next one could be
more
significantly
severe.
More severe. Right. So I think what we're going to see is the establishment of a new SOP that would allow for what would be a really severe infectious outbreak on a vessel like the Roosevelt. What do we do when it is Ebola? What do we do when it's something that was created in a lab intentionally to literally take an entire carrier strike group out of operation?
Well, and to me, what do you do when you don't know, which, you know, you're probably not going to know?
Exactly.
There's going to be a period of uncertainty that you're not sure, like there was with this. And then the default reaction was probably an overreaction. Right? But,
well, you know, an overreaction is always what it looks like when you do the right thing, right?
Well,
when it comes to something like this. So what we have to determine is.
But again, let me frame the question. So relative. The next time this happens, should an element of our thinking be this was done deliberately based on what somebody saw happen to the Western world with the COVID-19. Part of our response has got to be, we can't come down from our alert statuses. If anything, maybe we should be a little bit more vigilant and probably
we should be more alert,
right? Which means we're going to have to rigidly segregate ourselves off from people, but remain maintain our operational tempo, if not increase it. Because, I mean, look, if you're a bad actor, if you're a bad state actor, and you don't see the benefit of this to you.
This has been intelligence gathering Christmas, hasn't it?
Oh, my God. It's amazing.
You know, and honestly, I know that we have a bad habit as Americans of making a couple of assumptions that work, I would argue, the opposite of for our favor. The first is we assume that we've got it covered. And that victory is a foregone conclusion for the U.S. military. You know, James Mattis, I might be paraphrasing a bit, but he was like, we have no ordained right to victory on the battlefield. But as Americans, we tend to think that we do. And we tend to think that our technology is overwhelming to our opponents. We tend to think that we have a plan in place for everything. To go back to that UFO thing, whenever somebody thinks that they see a UFO in the sky, our assumption is that there are always F-16s scrambled and standing by all over the United States to respond to something like this, right? In movies, there's always fighter jets within 5 minutes of whatever the issue is. The truth is that our military is made up of people just like us, you know, that can make mistakes, that are human people, that are fallible. So that we have to change our strategy to allow for the very likelihood that we will make mistakes, the very likely possibility, like you said, that there will be uncertainty in those first days. And we have to make a plan that keeps those ships operating.
Right.
Because Lord knows, if there were to be a World War III, it is absolutely foolish of us to think that it would be fought in a conventional way. The leading blows of World War III, in my opinion, will almost certainly be digital and biological. You know, we already know that the Russian government has hacked into America's power grid, which is a number of different power grids, technically. The first shots of World War III will likely be first a cyber attack that will, I mean, America's entire military infrastructure on the continental United States relies on the public power grid. So if you can affect the public power grid, you can very literally affect our military apparatus's ability to respond, right? And then you combine that with a viral outbreak that doesn't even have to be anything more severe than the flu. And you saw what happened. I'm not contending that, you know, COVID is more or less, we'll find out how deadly COVID is. I'm not worried about the semantics.
No, but we're talking about the uncertainty that's generated.
Exactly. Right. You know, and right.
you've got to generate just enough to degrade the response that gives you
exactly
that relative edge in time to deliver some kind of substantial blow. So to me, that's really interesting stuff. And then the other thing, and let me ask you this question, Alex, and then I'll let you go. Let's just say in a peer-to-peer conflict, right? In a peer-to-peer conflict, do you have an idea, or do you go someplace to read? What does this look like, right? Do we blow their satellites out? Do they blow our satellites out, you know, in a peer competition? Do we then try to, in lower orbit, regenerate those capabilities? Because if we can't see and they can't see, you can have missiles that go forever. It doesn't matter because you're going to shoot a fixed target, it doesn't matter. And so how does that digital, to include communication satellites, to include satellites that look, spy satellites, if all that goes, right, then what? I've looked to read about it, because to me, right, that's to me the important fight is to see in this. And then if somebody clips the digital underwater cables that run through the Malaccan Straits, now mm-hmm. what? You've just denied them, you know, or at least mainland China. Now, if they're in other parts of the world, if they're in Europe or if they're in North America, they still have cells that could access your internet. But, you know, so what's the expectation of how this goes? Because we know, look, the Russians, they're down there screwing with those cables. Assume the Chinese are, and assume we are too. We're no strangers to that rodeo. And so, do you know of anybody that's written about the digital initial steps of a peer conflict?
Well, I do know that the concerns that you're talking. I've been over here nodding and like putting my hand up, like amen, the whole time. I can't agree more. A big part of why the Space Force was actually established is meant to address that concern. Right. And I think that that's one of the things that journalistically, especially in the mainstream media, that the media has really let the American people down on understanding why the Space Force is so important.
Oh, my. You know, let me tell you, I said a little bit ago, they will define, right, the conditions for victory. Because if we cannot see, right, it will the event may be protracted, and we don't do protracted events well. If we can see, that's akin to air superiority in past wars. Now we begin to take it down, and it will start with the Space Force.
And so one of the big things that the Space Force is focused on is, you know, pretty much their primary responsibility right now is tracking orbital bodies, right?
Right.
And the reason why you track orbital bodies, whether it's satellites or debris, is because you need to know when you can launch safely and to where. But you also need to know if anything's closing in on those assets that we rely on. And Heather Wilson, the former Secretary of the Air Force, she said it best when she said, you know, we built a glass house before the invention of stones. And what she meant was that the satellite infrastructure that we rely on for this stuff has practically no means of defense whatsoever. Some of them can't move to get out of their own way. You know, they're stuck in their orbital trajectory. Almost none of them have any means of defense against other satellites or debris that's kind of being projected at them. And that's the reason why we're so worried about like Russia's Inspector satellites, which are autonomous satellites that can move at free will and have grabbing arms that we have already tracked closing with NATO ally spy satellites. Very much we understand to collect intelligence off these satellites via their encrypted transmissions. Those all you need to do to take a satellite out of commission is give it a nudge. You don't even have to blow it up. If you give one of the satellites that we use for our early warning missile defense system, if you nudge it so that it's no longer oriented properly to see that little lens flare on its lens that it recognizes as a missile launch, if you nudge it or you laze it with a laser to kind of blind that lens, that's all it takes for a series of nuclear missiles to be launched at the U.S. that we no longer have the response time necessary to intercept. Right. Even worse, with one of those arms, all you need to do is drag a satellite into a slightly degrading orbit and then let it destroy itself. It'll burn itself up on reentry. Because of that, and I mean, whether we're talking, people don't realize GPS is it's a Defense Department initiative.
Right.
The GPS satellites are launched and maintained by the Defense Department. We allow the whole world to use it because if we were using it only to track where our battleships were around the ocean, anybody could gain access to the GPS system and find our battleships because they're the only transponders, right? So we let everyone use it to create enough radio chatter to let us use it like in a secure way, right? But China is already launching its own GPS constellation. The United States is trying to launch a hardened GPS constellation. Whether we're talking knowing where we are, being able to communicate with one another, or just the domino effect that we need to fall in the right way to intercept an inbound missile. All of these things rely on very vulnerable satellites. So one of the most important things the Space Force is trying to work on is a way to rapidly redeploy assets after they've been compromised. And that's one of the things the X-37 could feasibly do. We could use that to replace or stand in for a compromised satellite, especially if we had a pretty good fleet of them. But other thing on doing are finding ways to just really speed up the launch window. When I said that 10-year from, you know, design to deployment for a spy satellite, if we can expedite that to 2 years, if we can bring that down to 6 months if it's a piece of equipment we've already deployed before, it's going to make it so that the window of time that we go blind if a satellite or an orbit of satellites get compromised is going to shrink and shrink and shrink. But you're totally right. If we can't operate without those lights, we're in a whole lot of trouble.
Oh.
You know, if we can't operate without the satellites, we're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, no, all those systems depend on it. So again, if you can't see, and I would argue even that, you know, this whole discussion about the Marine Corps as, you know, in ships with Tomahawk cruise missiles, I would say the Navy needs us more as spotters than they do as shooters. We've got all kinds of shooters, right? But somebody who's in the region spotting, right, maybe, or protecting things that are going to get launched to spot, is, to me, that is strategic value, right? And shooters are a dime a dozen. So I'm very curious, as you could tell, I'm very curious about, you know, the local regeneration of these capabilities, or maybe the regional regeneration, you know. I mean, and like, so it would be the X-35 Bravo. I'm the pilot. You're in the cargo bay. We get it over the South China Sea. I'm like, now, Alex, kick it out. Poof. Right? And then we locate, you know, we turn the son of a bitch on. Before the Chinese can knock it out, we've zapped, like, you know, 27 of their ships, and now this shit's over. You know what I mean? And so,
and honestly, the other missing part of this that we need to make sure that we as a country get a good grip on is interoperability, right? So we need to be able to launch stuff that fast that can connect right into our network, which right now we're not that great at. You know, a good analogy I could give you is that a lot of the Army's equipment is like operating on the defense equivalent of Mac. And a lot of the Marine Corps' equipment is on the defense equivalent of PC. There's no way to plug them into each other, you know? We're pretty good about that inner branch. We're getting better about that inner branch, but we're still pretty bad about that inner nation in terms of, like, NATO allies cooperating with one another. So this is stuff that we really need to worry about. That's why the F-35, I know people talk about its stealth, but it really serves as an adapter between HIMARS systems, Navy ships, and all the feeds can all dump into the F-35, and it can transmit out a single data feed that kind of blends them all together. We need way more of that kind of stuff so that when satellites do get compromised and we do rapidly deploy a solution for that, we need to make sure that that solution is accessible by the Marine Corps, by the Navy, by submarines and the Pentagon, feasibly by Italian carriers as much as by our own. And that's a really, really difficult thing to do. So we have to get better at all of this stuff. And to bring it back to, like, the virus thing, especially knowing now how easy it is to biologically compromise our ability to fight on two fronts. If you were to do it biologically and digitally, we'd be in a whole lot of trouble. And you don't have to be as big, as powerful, or as well-funded as the United States military to really hurt the United States military. If you're the Chinese, looking at the U.S. military, it makes for a very target-rich environment. There's a lot of targets for you to point your missiles at, you know? And in a very real way, when it comes to our stealth aircraft or our carriers in particular, we may have more than anybody, but losing just one is a big deal, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, the whole concept of, you know, what if, but again, to kind of end this discussion, if you're a DOD planner, if you're a military planner, and you don't see how this has disabled much of the world to include, you know, much of people's military shuttered in place and whatnot, biological warfare is, once again, looms over the country. What's the next thing you're writing? And, you know, the whole sandbox thing kind of got going as a way to connect families with recruits, and now recruit training's changed a little bit. They got to go to 2 weeks of quarantine. Do those guys have access to sandbox accounts when they're quarantining?
Right now, unfortunately, not. And the basic reason behind that is that logistically, on Paris Island and at MCRD San Diego, the mailroom guys, effectively, it's already really tough for them to get everything coordinated with recruits as they're getting to their appropriate squad bays, as they're classing up. So with all these guys in that 2 weeks of isolation, basically the infrastructure hasn't caught up yet. Yeah. To make it really easy to get them mail. But one thing, anybody who's got a family member thinking about joining or that's heading out there, it's important to note that during those 2 weeks of quarantine, however, those recruits may not be able to receive mail, but they can send you mail. You know, so one thing that Sandbox is doing is we are sending literally thousands of stationery, envelopes, pens, to San Diego and Paris Island, just to give those guys something to do, guys and girls, something to do. We don't actually make any money off you guys sending letters, but because our entire business model is surrounded by you guys sending letters, we feel like it's the least that we can do by getting you guys a bunch of free stationery and stuff so that at least you can send letters to help stave off the boredom.
Nice.
But I do think that we're going to see basic training change consistently throughout, you know, and as they identify potential threats and act to mitigate them, I just ask that families that are out there just be aware of the fact that the commanders, whether we're talking MCRD Paris Island or we're talking Fort Leonard Wood or wherever it may be, you know, Great Lakes, the commanders on site, the senior enlisted advisors on site are looking at the problem every day. And they're making decisions every day to try to mitigate any potential threats. So I know it's frustrating and stressful right now to have a family member there because you're like, where is my son? Where's my wife? You know, can someone tell me how things are going? They're working really hard, but their first priority is health and safety. The second priority is morale. So as things get better, they're going to be able to communicate with you more. But right now, just rest assured that the reason why things are hectic is because their focus is entirely on the health and safety aspect. Once we have that unlocked, then we can work on the rest of stuff.
Do I lose my phone when I go into quarantine? I'm not at recruit training yet.
It's varied by branch. I believe the Marine Corps does not have access to your phone while you're in that isolation because you turn over all your gear when you first arrive just like you would any other time. Actually, right now for Paris Island, they're actually housing recruits at the Citadel.
Right. So I don't have my cell phone while I'm at the Citadel?
Negative. I do not believe that you do. I think that there are periods of classroom instruction that recruits are getting during that time. And I'm sure there are working parties. So they're still plenty busy, I'd imagine. But I think because they're moving around so much and stuff like that, that's why mail can't get to them quite yet. I also think that one of the reasons why they're not having their phone is just because from an OPSEC standpoint, it's a moving target, right? So, but from my understanding, they don't have their phone, but some of the other branches are allowing students to keep their phones. And then on the opposite side of basic training, another thing to be considered is that they're not being allowed their 11 days of boot leave or 9 days of boot leave anymore either. So these guys are going directly from MCRDs to either MCT or to SOI. So more than ever, they could really use hearing from you. You know, I know when I was at recruit training, I was counting down the days until I'd see my wife again. And now these guys and these girls who are going through recruit training don't have that. So send them letters, send them pictures, send them anything, you know. Even if you can't think of anything to write today, just, you know, one or two lines will mean a lot to a person who – you know, they were counting down until they'd get to go back home, and now that countdown just got a whole lot longer.
Got it. What are you writing, and tell everybody where they find it?
Well, definitely please check us out on Sandbox News with two X's. It's sandboxwith2xsnews.com. We've got a bunch of really good stuff coming up this week, not just from me, but from really cool guys. I've got an article going up tomorrow from a Navy SEAL turned CIA operator about how you can make it through Navy SEAL training. I'm really proud of a story we published on Friday by retired Green Beret Warrant Officer Steve Ballastieri. It's all about how women can find their way into the Special Forces community. It acknowledges the challenges. It acknowledges kind of the boys club environment, but it also gives very pragmatic, very practical options on how you can, as a woman, become a Green Beret, written by a guy who used to work in Green Beret selection. So I love that story. I love that Steve was willing to write it. But I've got a bunch of good stuff coming out this week that's just positive oriented, you know, some good old fashioned comfort crap like great military movies and stuff like that. We're trying to move a little bit away from the bad news parade that is COVID-19, especially because I think the military is starting to really get a handle on it to a certain extent. So you're going to see some more pop culture stuff, but you're also going to see some hard hitting stuff from Navy SEALs. I've got a military intend. Either this week or next week, we've also got a new series based entirely around how to be an entrepreneur, either as a military person, as a veteran, or as a military spouse, written by an investment banker who worked with Bunker Labs for a long time. He still works for, I believe it's called Humble Ventures. This is a guy who specializes in helping military businesses get off the ground. So I'm really excited about this series. There's a bunch of awesome new stuff coming out on Sandbox News. I really encourage you, please read my work. But honestly, the work that I've got published from some of these people, some of these special operations guys, these CIA guys, it's really interesting to me. So I hope it's really interesting to you, too.
There you have it. Alex Hollings on a Monday. All right. Continued good health to your mom, and manage your schedule better.
Thank you. I will genuinely try. I'll report in 2 weeks whether or not I managed to actually develop a human schedule.
You've been officially counseled. All right, Alex, thank you.
Have a good one, man.
There you have it. Alex Hollings here on a Monday morning. That'll do it on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio. If you're just tuning in, talk about the news in hour one. To include the changing landscape of retail, how what Amazon started, COVID-19 is finished. And you're going to see more and more retailers go into bankruptcy and never, ever come out of it. Right. Right. So if you like your local retailer, you might want to patronize him or her. So we'll talk about that a little bit. Breaking news in the last couple hours. The shooting at NAS Pensacola has now been linked to ISIS. So that's in the news today. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And then if you just tuned in, Alex Hollings. Yeah. He joined us here on a Monday as well. So tomorrow you're going to hear Joe Galloway. Yeah, in an interview I did with him about an upcoming book. Talk about a whole lot of things. So, exciting stuff. So you'll hear Joe on, you'll hear him tomorrow. So, have a great day. Don't be afraid to change somebody's life. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. And on a Monday, I am over and out.